Hello and welcome to episode 40. That's 40. Episode 40 of Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast. The goulash episode, we'll call it that, because it's going to include a whole lot of stuff. I'm Jerry Shario, and it's my pleasure, as always, to turn the control panel over to actor, director, playwright, author of the book, The Annotated Abbott and Costello, a man who didn't make Who's Who, but he sure as heck knows what's what. Here's Nick Santamaria.
What's Vaults? Oh, wait a minute. That's from Whodunit. We're not doing that today.
No. Next thing you know, you'll be telling me what's on second base.
I don't know. He's on third. Okay, we're done. Good night, everyone. Jerry. That was a lot of entertainment for a short amount of time. I said that during my last prison sentence. You know, I went to a bagel place. I asked for lox and they put me away. So anyway, Jerry, how are you, pal?
I'm doing very well, my friend. Doing well. I tell people I'm in New York, but technically I'm in Newark. That is where I've been staying.
And had Jerry Lewis.
Yes. And a few other things, apparently, but I never bothered to find out because I went to Paterson.
Oh, wait a minute. You went to Paterson, New Jersey?
I most certainly did. First time ever.
Okay. I don't know if you know this, Jerry. I'm not sure if you're aware of this.
Okay.
But one of the guys we celebrate on this podcast, Lou Costello, is from Paterson, New Jersey. I'm not sure if you know that.
No.
Why else would you go to Paterson?
Especially since it was an hour, 15-minute bus ride from here. Yeah.
Worth it to see that stat. Mm-hmm.
Most definitely.
It's a pilgrimage. It's a pilgrimage for me when I go to that part of the country. I've got to go say hello to Lou. And if I could, you know, I'd probably get arrested if I climbed up, but I would clean, like, the pigeon droppings off his hat.
Yeah. Yep.
But it is. It's a great statue. It looks just like him. And I love that he's holding a baseball bat. Because in that area, you want a baseball bat. Trust me. I kid. I love Paterson. And I go every time I have a chance. So tell me about your experience. You mentioned like a miracle from Lou.
Yes. Well, as I said, about hour 15, hour 20 bus ride. And all the way up, skies were dark and threatening. And the wind was blowing. It was a dark and stormy afternoon kind of thing. And I got to the Paterson bus terminal, got out my phone, you know, found my way to the little Lou Costello Memorial Park. And when I got there, the sun broke through the clouds and it was gorgeous. I got the best pictures with the sun out and it was unbelievable. I enjoyed the park. There are a couple of plaques there. I made sure, you know, I read every little word as I like to do.
They mentioned Bud, which is nice.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And so then, you know, that was wonderful. And I was going to move on to the next event in Paterson. I was not a block away from the park when the skies burst open and rain poured down.
See, I have a feeling that when you were in the park, Lou was looking after you. Yep. But when you left the park, the spirit of Eddie Sherman rained on you. We know what a creep he was. Yeah. So that's wonderful that you made it. But the next time you go, you have to go to the Paterson Museum, where there is a whole section dedicated to Lou.
Yeah.
So anyway, well, that's for next time.
Exactly. You got to save something for the next time.
Exactly. So let's explain what we're doing here today. I'm going to
explain
it as simply as possible because Jerry is a very simple human being.
Yes, okay. I am.
So here we go. It's a single-celled organism because you can only sit in one cell at a time. That's what we do. So I was a single-cell organism in prison. So, okay, what we're doing is we are taking Lou's General Electric Theater episode, Blaze of Glory. Then we're going to look at the Bud Abbott scenes in his General Electric Theater, This Laugh is on Me. And then we're going to look at some shorter things. I want to look at a few novelty things. One is some kind of rare footage of Lou with a young model showing off his latest invention that he invested in. He invested $50,000 in the Costello ice maker. I forget what it is. It's a clever title. I forget what it is. But anyway, we'll see that. And he demonstrates it for the young lady. And of course, it, like most of his investments, it went down the toilet. although those machines became a regular thing in society. So he was a little, like most of his work, he was a little ahead of his time. So we have that. And we've got his appearance, three appearances on the Steve Allen show as a solo. One is not complete, but it shows you what they were trying to do. This is a scene, a short scene, a musical scene, an operetta spoof that they did in their last Vegas show. Actually, Lou did most of the work in that. But it was when we get there, I'll talk about it. Okay. So the first thing we're going to be looking at, we're going to give you the signal to start your version on your device. So our listeners, our beloved, wonderful listeners, have a somehow to watch on YouTube these episodes along with us. We're going to give you a countdown from five and say begin. And that's when we're all going to hit play at the same time, starting at zero. Okay? So just go to YouTube, find Blaze of Glory, Lou Costello. We'll have the links in when we post this. And we will all begin at the same time. And you'll listen to Jerry and myself make comments. The reason this has come up is it has been suggested to me several times from listeners to do this with their films, for Jerry and I to watch the films with you and comment. And we might do that with some of the films down the road. But in the meantime, I want to get to all these bits and pieces. I eventually want to get to the television shows. I want to get to their radio work, although not really in depth because the show wasn't in depth. Mm-hmm. In fact, I didn't think it was a great show, to be honest with you. So we'll discuss that. And that's all in the future. So we have a lot to do. We have a lot to get to. So let's begin with the General Electric Theater, hosted by Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan! He hosted it from 1953 to 1962. Can you imagine? That's a 9-year run of hosting. And he appeared in a few of them, too. The final year was the 62-63 season, which was hosted by Jack Webb. It was on Sunday nights from 9 o'clock until 9:30 on CBS. And Lou was contracted to do this really cute little sitcom-y kind of show. It's a half-hour show. Unfortunately, it has a laugh track. I don't think they needed it, but then I never do. And it has some wonderful supporting players that we're going to be discussing at length while we watch. Okay, so why don't we go with our very first GE Theater, Blaze of Glory, and we will begin on Jerry's countdown.
Here we go. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, begin.
And there are those spotlights going on.
Oh, yeah.
Introducing us to the GE Theater.
Feel like I'm about to watch the Bugs Bunny cartoon show on Saturday morning here.
That's what it looks like, doesn't it?
Yeah. And there's the man himself.
Look at that chair. Oh, my goodness. Ronald Reagan. I just love to hear him say Lou Costello. I love to hear him say the name because he's the president, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we skipped the commercial, thank goodness.
Yes.
And now here we go. Here's Ronnie is sitting there looking like a young Republican. In his beautiful suit and his tie. If I know the Republicans, it's probably a red tie. And there he is. He just mentioned Lou. And here it is. Review Productions, 1958. Broadcast. No, wait. When was this broadcast? September 21st, 1958. Now, this woman playing Lou's wife, getting ready for bed, is Loreen Tuttle. She was born in 1907 in Pleasant Lake, Indiana. She had strong ties to show business. Her father was Claire Tuttle. He'd been a performer in minstrel shows. Her grandfather, Frank Tuttle, managed an opera house and taught drama. Her mother, Verna Tuttle, discovered her knack for acting when they moved to Glendale, Arizona. She started doing theater there. And now there's Lou with his pajamas on, coming in with his pajamas. Now, you watch this, and Jerry, I don't know about you, but when I'm watching him, I'm thinking he could have easily had a sitcom. He could have started.
Oh, yeah.
And he's proving it here.
Oh,
he said when he would get home from things like this, he would realize just how easy it was. He would come home from his slapstick movies aching with bruises and blood and all this stuff. He says,
"Yep,
it's I come home and I feel great. I don't feel like a But anyway, look at him, how cute he is in his pajamas. And
he's also
really good.
And he's also made a very wise choice here. You know, they're having a little snack before bed, and he's sitting on her bed eating the sandwich, so no crumbs get into his bed.
You know? No crumbs.
Yeah.
But anyway, he's getting a phone call now, and the phone call is a very mysterious one. There's Joyce Jameson, the beautiful Joyce Jameson, sad case, actually. But she's asking him to come do a plumbing job deep into the night. And he's not supposed to wear his usual outfit, his plumbing clothes. They want him to wear a suit and tie. So anyway, he feels like she's a damsel in distress and he's going to help her out. But in the meantime, back to Lorene Tuttle. She was one of the great radio voices during the golden age of radio. And she, this is my favorite, she was on the Red Skelton Show as Junior, the Mean Whittle Kid's mother.
Yes.
Now Junior. And she was also Daisy June for Clem Cadiddlehopper.
Well, Daisy June.
What is it, Clem? Howdy, Clem. Anyway, if she only did that, I'd be a fan for life.
Yeah.
She appeared on a sitcom of based on Life with Father, the great Broadway hit. And that was 1953 to 1955. She played Vinnie, the wife, to Leon Ames, who played the father in the father with the life in him. But anyway, she was in Macbeth, Orson Welles' Macbeth as one of the three witches. She was in Mr. Blandings Builds His Dream House, one of my all-time favorites.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Blandings Builds His Dream House. She was in Psycho. See, all little roles, all small roles. She played the mother in Don't Bother to Knock, one of Marilyn Monroe's first really big movies. And she got a lead role in 1960 when she played Ma Barker in Ma Barker's Killer Brood.
Wow.
I suggest you watch it, though, by the way. It's a lot of fun. Jerry, look for it.
Okay.
And let's see. Her last film was Testament in 1983. This is very interesting because she was very big in the development and beginnings of AFTRA, the American Federation of Radio and Television Artists. And this is what happened. She appeared regularly on a show called Hollywood Hotel. Dick Powell was on it, Luella Parsons. It was a big show. And also on that show was Frank Nelson.
Yes.
And between the two of them, they realized that the guest stars on Hollywood Hotel made $5,000 a piece. $5,000. This was back in the late 30s. So you can imagine what it was, you know, in today's money.
Yeah.
They got together, put their heads together, and asked for a raise to $35 a week. So while they were making $35, the stars were making $5,000. There was a little inequity there. They decided to put their heads together and start a union. And she was one of the formative members. So good for you, Lorene. I'm part of your union myself, and I appreciate it. She passed away in 1986. Okay, now look at Lou here. Lou's all dressed up. He's in a car with a couple of mugs. These guys are gangsters. And he has no idea what they want or where they're bringing him or anything like that. It's very mysterious. So they're taking him to a hotel, and he realizes he's in trouble. And you see, he just tried to escape. He was going to walk out of a moving car. And when I say moving, I don't mean emotionally. I mean, you know. These guys are really threatening. He's got a real threat. But when you see the leader of the gang, this is where it gets a lot of fun. because he's someone we all know and love. And he's basically always plays a cowardly, almost sissified character, and very cultured and all this. So I'm going to tell you about him because there's a lot to say before I'm going to tell you before he appears. Now, we all grew up watching Lost in Space, right? Irwin Allen's cheesy, you know, science fiction show. And the star of the show was a guy by the name of Jonathan Harris, and he played Dr. Smith. Now, Jerry, Dr. Smith, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Grew up watching him?
Oh, yes. Yes, oh, the pain, yes.
You bumbling booby. Yes, I picture him hiding behind Will, you know, whenever Trump
yes.
he hides behind the little boy. But we loved him. We loved his character. And here's the story. He came into the pilot episode late. They hired him late in the game. There were a couple of guys up for the role, but they eventually decided on him. And the character was a villain. He was, first of all, because he was late to the production, he couldn't get the normal billing that he usually got, because he did a lot of television before this. He did a lot of television and movies and Broadway. But anyway, he asked for special guest star Jonathan Harris, and it was on every single episode for 3 seasons. And boy, was the cast, anyway, everyone but Billy Mummy just hated him. Because he was supposed to be the villain. He was supposed to be a dark, serious villain. And if you see that pilot episode, you know he's the one that screws everything up and gets them lost in space.
Yep.
Well, as the show went on, more and more, first of all, I have to tell you this. Oh, there he is, right there, looking at him in his dressing gown. He looks great. He looks great. He looks weird without a robot, but he looks great. He was born Jonathan Daniel Charasushin, Charasushin, C-H-A-R-A-S-U-C-H-I-N. And he was born in 1914 in, ready? The Bronx.
Of course.
The Bronx, New York. Mm-hmm. And he had a Bronx accent, you know? Can you imagine? Mm. Oh, the pain. Oh, Will. Oh, you bumbling booby. But that's not what happened. He actually hated his Bronx accent, and he used to go to an art theater nearby and see the British movies that came in, and he taught himself to sound the way he eventually sounded. So he did it himself. He also, talking about doing it yourself, he is the person that created Dr. Smith. It wasn't the writers. It was, you know, they had an idea of what they wanted eventually, seeing where he was going. But he is the one that would rewrite his dialogue and put in all those great alliterative insults to the robot, you know, you clunking collection of collagenous junk. That's from The Wizard of Oz, actually. But but it's the same idea. So he would come in with script ideas, and I have a quote from Billy Mummy. He said he moved very quickly to develop this character, and he said we'd start working on a scene together, and he'd have a line, and then in the script I'd have my reply, and then he would say, no, dear boy, no, before you say that, the robot will say this, and this, and then you'll deliver the line. He truly, truly, single-handedly created the character of Dr. Zachary Smith that we both know, this man we love to hate, the coward who would cower behind the little boy. Oh, the pain, save me, William. That was all him. So imagine, what's his name? Guy, who was the lead? Guy Zorro.
Guy Williams.
Guy Williams, thank you. My memory is just going away. It's on vacation forever. Excuse me. Guy Williams was the lead of the show. And he watched every week his part get smaller and smaller and smaller. And I told him not to swim in a cold pool, but oh, no, wait, not that. His other part, his role got smaller and smaller and smaller. That was dirty. And they hated Jonathan Harris for this because they knew he was responsible for this. And He got more mail than anybody. He got the best reviews. And the producer said, you know, guys, sorry, but we have to go with what's popular, with what the audience is telling us. And that was it. It became the Dr. Smith Show. And let's face it, that's what we loved about it. You know, we loved the whole relationship between him and Will and the robot. I couldn't care less about, you know, no offense to the late June Lockhart or Guy Williams or Marta Kristen or the other. Who's the other guy? He died recently. He was my least favorite character in the show because he was so negative. He was so, we can't do that, Dr. Smith. You're an idiot. Blah, blah, blah. He was negative about everything. And I used to hate him when I was a kid. Then when he passed away, I started reading tributes to him. He was such an incredible person. He was such an incredible, nice, charitable, kind human being. And he was just playing against type. So I'm sorry that I put all that negative energy out there. But so the show lasted three seasons, Lost in Space. But the show before that, I don't know, you're probably too young for this, Jerry. we're the same age. But
yes!
I mean mentally. No, I remember one of the first experiences I remember from watching television was the Bill Dana Show. And on the show was not only Don Adams playing the house detective of the hotel where, you know, Jose Jimenez worked as a bellboy. Don Adams developed the Get Smart character on that show, and it got him Get Smart eventually. But Jonathan Harris played the pompous, sissified Franklin Pangborn role, you know, as the manager of the hotel. And I remember him. I remember all of that. And I remember it being so funny. I was such a fan of Jose Jimenez. I know you can't do that now. They consider it racist. But I watch it on YouTube secretly. And, you know, I'm hoping nobody will break in and arrest me. Because I would just turn around and say, screw you! So anyway, he did a lot of television afterwards, a lot of voice work. He did some children's television. He was on a show called Space Academy, Uncle Croc's Block, which is a fascinating idea.
Yes.
Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. They played children's performers on a television show, on a really bad television show.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't remember it at all, but yeah, I read about it. Let's see. He did everything. He did Fantasy Island, Night Gallery, then voices on The Banana Splits, Rainbow Bright, Darkwing Duck, Spider-Man, A Bug's Life, and Toy Story 2. In fact, so his last work was recording a voice on, I love the name of this, it's a Christmas theatrical short, animated, called The Bolt, B-O-L-T, Who Screwed Christmas. The Bolt Who Screwed Christmas. I have to see this, you know?
Wow.
They didn't release it until 2009, but he was already dead. He died of he had a back injury and he had to go in to the hospital and he developed a blood clot and he passed away 3 days before his 88th birthday in 2002. Okay, now if you're watching our film as we go, here's the deal. They are jewel thieves and murderers, apparently, and they lost a diamond ring down the sink. That's why they called the plumber. He had to wear a suit because they didn't want to attract any untoward attention in the hotel room. And now they're telling Lou what he has to do in their bathroom to get to the diamond ring. And of course, they're threatening his life and everything else. He's in big trouble. He's in big trouble here. Now, our blonde. No, actually, first of all, there's a dead body on the couch.
Yes.
When he comes in, he sits down and he starts talking to this body and he doesn't realize the guy's dead. And the dead guy turns out to be Phil Arnold, who I've seen in about 9,000 movies and television shows. And he always plays kind of the same thing. This ineffectual little bald guy who gets in the way. In fact, I was just watching the Ritz Brothers. They did a 4-star Playhouse thing. No, not 4-star Playhouse. Four-star review. And they hosted. And Phil is on the show as a sight gag. He's a sight gag. He plays the sponsor, and they grab him and they drag him out of the theater. It's very funny. But Phil is in over 200 movies and television shows. Born in Hackensack, New Jersey, right near you right now, Jerry. You can go visit his statue, but it's too ineffectual to find. and he passed away of a heart attack in 1968. Wow, he was only, 59 years old? Too bad. I love spotting him in movies, by the way. I just think he's a very funny presence. Okay, so there's Lou. He makes a big deal about how difficult this operation is going to be to find the ring, when actually all he had to do was take a little plate out of the sink and it's there. So, but he's not telling them this. He's going to go through the whole rigmarole of ripping up the floor and all this. And his plan is to get the attention of the people downstairs so he can be saved, along with Joyce Jameson, the blonde gun moll, who actually has a heart of gold. And let's talk about Joyce, because I love her. I just think she's wonderful. And I loved seeing her in those early Vincent Price movies. And anyway, let's talk about Joyce Jameson. There she is. Look how pretty. Such a pretty girl. She was born in Chicago in 1927. She ended up in Los Angeles eventually. These are the spotty things I found about her. She got a Bachelor of Arts degree in acting. In the early 50s, she started doing uncredited roles in films. She made her debut as a chorus girl in Showboat, the 1951 remake with Ava Gardner and Katherine Grayson. Mm-hmm. She was also in Problem Girls in 1953. Tip on a Dead Jockey. I love that title. Tip on a Dead Jockey. 1957. And she has an uncredited role in The Apartment, Billy Wilder's great movie from 1960. In 1962, she shows up with Vincent Price and Peter Lorre in the Roger Corman film Tales of Terror, and she plays Annabelle Herringbone. she's Lorre's vulgar, unfaithful wife, and during the film, she's having an affair with Vincent Price, and Lorre, in true Edgar Allan Poe fashion, seals them up behind a brick wall and suffocates the both of them. That'll teach him. 2 years later, she shows up in another one, and this is The Comedy of Terrors, and mm-hmm. that's 1964. She, again, played, I think she played the wife, or is it the daughter, of Boris Karloff. This one has Boris Karloff, Vincent Price, Peter Lorre, Basil Rathbone, and are you ready? Joe E. Brown in a cameo. And it's his last work on film, and he even gets in a Joe E. Brown yell. So anyway, that she's wonderful in these films, and they're all available. You should seek them out because they're so much fun. She also shows up as a hooker in one of my favorite 60s comedies, Good Neighbor Sam. She's in the Elvis Presley film Frankie and Johnny, one of the worst movies I've ever seen. She's in a movie, a Bob Hope movie I actually saw in a theater called Boy, Did I Get the Wrong Number? with Bob Hope and Elkie Summer. And boy, when she gets out of the bathtub with just the suds around her, I reached adulthood. And I was only 9 years old. anyway, she had roles in Death Race 2000, which was made in 1975. She's in The Outlaw Josie Wales, Every Which Way But Loose, and Hard Bodies in 1984. Now, my favorite Joyce Jameson role, other than what she did in the Roger Corman films, was the Andy Griffith Show. Do you remember the Fun Girls?
Oh, yeah.
She was one of the Fun Girls. She was the prettier one with the less offensive voice. The other one was Jean Carson, who talked like this. Hi, doll. Andy, here come the Fun Girls. Hi, doll. Now, Barn. Anyway, so she was one of the Fun Girls. I love that. She did three not very successful Broadway shows. She was married to an actor-songwriter, Billy Barnes. They had one child before they divorced. But eventually she was the longtime girlfriend of Robert Vaughn from Man from U.N.C.L.E. And apparently he wrote in his autobiography that she was very, she suffered from depression and insomnia, terrible insomnia. Mm. And she committed suicide in her home, overdosing on pills in 1987. Mm. I hate that because she's so gorgeous and so talented. Now look at Lou. Lou is standing off these gangsters with a flamethrower that he uses in his plumbing. And they can't come near him. This guy's reaching for a gun. He's shooting the flames at them. This is Lou Costello. And, you know, it's like, screw you, crooks. I got you under control. I'm calling the police, and you're all going to jail. And see how, you know, hoity-toity Dr. Smith can be in jail. Oh, the pain. So Lou actually becomes the hero. This is his blaze of glory in this wonderful half-hour episode. And there he is. He's still shooting that flamethrower at them. Joyce is safely behind him. And now he's calling the cops. And Lou is just terrific in this GE Theater episode.
Now connected to Nicholas's second Fire TV stick.
That was my Alexa. Sorry about that. Okay. So he also ordered a pack of gum for Joyce, who's been asking for gum since the beginning of the episode. Look at him. He is just the best. Now he's coming home, and he has to explain to his wife why he's been gone all this time. And I love that he's wearing a fedora with a turned-up brim. It just reminds me of you know, happier times. Mm-hmm. So he woke up Lorraine. She's like, where have you been? And now she's asking, did you have any trouble? And he's, oh, no, it's just something I had to get out of a drain. Don't worry about it. Ah, and now he's kissing her goodnight. And as far as I'm concerned, he could walk right now to Danny Thomas's studios and ask for his own sitcom.
Yeah.
You know? I really, really think that that's where he was heading. People ask me all the time. It's like, do you think he would be a movie star? Do you think he would do Fiorello LaGuardia or, you know, whatever? I think the next logical step was the Lou Costello show.
Yeah.
Now connected to Nicholas's second Fire
TV. Shut up, Alexa. And there's Lou with his final close-up and the closing credits. This was 1958, directed by Don Weiss, written by James Allardyce, starring Lou Costello. How weird to see his name so big and so alone.
Yeah. You
know? Anyway, that was a terrific episode. And the next one we're going to see is Bud Abbott's episode of the General Electric Theater. Now, there's a little bit of a difference here in the episodes. I'm going to turn off this now, produced by Review. Okay. How'd you like that, Jer? It was a good episode, eh?
Yeah. That one I had seen before. You know, some of the stuff that you sent along I had not seen before, but that one, I've always enjoyed it. And wholeheartedly agree with you. It really showcased much more so than, say, 30 Foot Bride of Candy Rock, because, you know, that was supposed to be something different. And he gave the impression that he was aiming toward some type of sitcom, you know, between Dance With Me, Henry, and then 30 Foot Bride. He was definitely heading in that direction. And this is, as you say, this is proof right here that, yeah, he could have done it. He could have had his own half-hour show.
No doubt. He would have had I'm trying to think. I would kill to set up the situation, to go back in time, and let's say 1960, the Lou Costello show. He's married to, you know, whatever. He's married to a woman. He's got a couple of kids. You know, he has a job. But the neighbor is the one who gets him into the most trouble, and that would be Bud Abbott. Now I know that some people would think, oh no, they have to be billed together, but I see it as the Lou Costello show with Bud Abbott. You know what I mean? And that would have kept them together, not doing the same stuff all the time, not doing the old routines, but moving forward in the way of the world at the time. You put a sitcom up. A lot of movie stars ended up in sitcoms or television shows. So, you know, I just think had Lou not died so young, that's what we would have had. So let's talk about Bud for a second.
Okay.
Now, this episode of GE Theater was done in 1961, April 16th, and Charlie Chaplin's birthday in 1961. And Bud had not worked at all since the breakup. He he actually refused because, well, not that there were many offers, but he knew that the government would take everything. So why work? He felt terrible about that, of course. But he finally came out of his retirement, you know, and you figure he hadn't worked since 1956. And this was 5 years later. So he got a supporting role, a strong supporting role in a GE theater. It wasn't like Lou got his own starring vehicle. This is why I said Lou Costello Show with Bud Abbott.
Yeah.
Bud got a nice supporting role as the star's agent. And he does very well for himself. I really, really like his work in this. And you could see where he was heading, you know? In this, he comes off as older than he actually was. He's, what is he, 64 here. And I think he looks a little older, I tell you the truth. He looks like an, how can I put this? He looks like an older character actor, basically. And he's playing a very mild-mannered character. He's playing very against type here. And this is what I mean about how impressed I am by Bud in this. He's not his usual rambunctious, abusive, you know, constantly questioning you, giving you impossible situations. He's a very sympathetic, a very put upon agent of a very obnoxious Don Rickles type comedian. Now, we only have Bud's scenes here that were posted on YouTube. But we can pretty much see where this is going, you know, eventually. The star of this episode is the great Lee Marvin. I could talk, let me talk about him now, just because we only have 11 minutes to watch, and then we, you know, comment as we go. But he was born, are you ready? Lamont Waltman Marvin Jr. Can you imagine? Lamont?
Wow.
who was Lamont? Was that Sanford and Son?
That was the Son. Yeah. Lamont. It was also The Shadow, but you know.
Oh, Lamont Cranston. Very good. Very good. Wow. Sometimes, Jerry, you just impress the hell out of me. And it's not all looks. So here we are. He's born in New York City in 1924, the same year my dad was born. And he was born to a World War I Army Corps of Engineer veteran. And the military became very important to their family in general. He was also an advertising executive, and his mother was a fashion writer. I found this very interesting. Not only was he a first cousin, six times removed, from George Washington, he was also a first cousin, I think four times removed, from General Robert E. Lee.
Whoa.
So he was related to the father of our country and a guy who wanted to split our country. It's really no wonder he drank, you know. That's really weird. But anyway, he went to weird schools. He attended the Manumit School, which was a Christian socialist boarding school in Pauling, New York.
Wow.
Would get today, you know, and now they have a socialist mayor in New York City. Then he went to the Peekskill Military Academy in Peekskill, New York. That's upstate. Then he attended St. Leo College Preparatory School, a Catholic school in St. Leo, Florida, which I've never heard of at all. And then he graduated from there after being expelled from several other schools for bad behavior, smoking cigarettes, truancy, fighting. He was a rough kid. But I told you that his family was very into the military, and he joined the Marine Corps for World War II and was wounded actually a few times. He was shot by machine gun fire, and it actually severed his sciatic nerve. I can't imagine the pain. He was also hit in the foot by a sniper. So he had to get over a year of medical treatment in hospitals. Oh, it says naval hospitals. But anyway, he was given a medical discharge with the rank of private first class. He was a corporal, but he was demoted for troublemaking. so anyway, he got out of the army, and he decided he was going to go into acting because he was tired of being, are you ready, a plumber's assistant, which is what he was. Which is interesting because Leo Gorcey started the same way. He was a plumber's assistant that actually just drifted over to the play Dead End. So, okay, he moved to Greenwich Village. He joined an acting company where he got $7 a week. And then eventually, with the GI Bill, he sponsored himself in the American Theater Wing and went to school there. He appeared on stage in the original version of Billy Budd, which was called Uniform of Flesh. He appeared in the 19th Hole of Europe on Broadway, didn't really go. Started working in television. He did everything, every show that we can think of. He made his film debut in a movie called You're in the Navy Now in 1951, directed by the great Henry Hathaway. It also marked the debut of Charles Bronson and Jack Warden. They were shooting in Hollywood, so he actually made his way there and decided to stay. He worked with a lot of people. He worked with Fred Zinnemann, but then eventually he became a star in 1965. And this is after he was already like a television star. He did a show called M Squad, which was very popular for a few seasons. He played the lead in that. But then he really became a star, an international movie star with the movie Cat Ballou. Now, yes. He was a villain before this, right? Cat Ballou, yes. One of my favorite movies. But before that, he was pretty much typed as a villain. He was playing, you know, let's think about the man who shot Liberty Valance. Was there anyone more ornery or villainous than Lee Marvin? He was just wonderful. But this movie, he played a dual role. He played Kid Chalene, the killer, and he looked great with that black outfit and the silver nose. Somebody shot his nose off. And then as the drunk... she hires to get rid of him. And I think they're brothers. I think they're brothers in the movie. Yeah. But anyway, his drunk routine won him an Oscar for Best Actor. There are some who think he doesn't deserve it, that it was a strictly a comical performance. But I take issue. I take issue. Because the Oscars are snobs. All right. I'm going to say, before we go any further, maybe we should start the movie. And then I could go through the rest of this stuff. But before we do that, I just want to mention that in 1965, he did a movie called Ship of Fools, where he really proved himself as a great actor, working for Stanley Kramer from It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. And then 2 years later, he made a movie that if he only made this one movie, I would be his biggest fan. And it's just, it's amazing. The Dirty Dozen. I could watch that movie again and again and again. In fact, I saw it first run. My older brother took me, and I was traumatized by the opening scene, the hanging scene. They hang this man, and I just couldn't believe it. This is what they do to people? I was 8 years old. So anyway, that movie is just, that solidified everything. He was actually cast in The Wild Bunch in the William Holden role, but quit because he got into an argument with Sam Peckinpah. So instead, Bright Boy went over to do Paint Your Wagon, the musical, with Clint Eastwood singing, I talk to the trees, that's why they put me away. And he actually has a few songs, but his solo actually did very well as a recording. I Was Born Under a Wandering Star.
Yep.
And it sounds like this.
Under a wandering star.
It's almost like he had a heavy meal and was burping the song. But I'll tell you the truth. My mom took my sister and I to see that, and I loved it. And I still love it. I still think it's a fun movie. Very underrated, I think.
Yeah.
He made a lot of movies, a lot of great movies. But he also, he turned down the role of Quint in Jaws, the Robert Shaw role.
Yeah.
And this is funny. He said he declined, saying, what would I tell my fishing buddies who'd see me come off as a hero against a dummy shark? So he just didn't want to do it. He was mostly famous towards the end. He was mostly famous for a palimony suit. In fact, Michelle Triola was his, they were not married. They lived together for about 6 years. And when they finally split up, she took him to court for half his money. And he was a millionaire by this point. The judge ordered him to pay her $104,000, which to me sounds fair. But then she wanted $3.6 more as palimony. And this went through the courts. Do you remember this? I remember as a kid hearing about all this. Crazy. And she was unsuccessful, thank goodness. She did not get that money. But she did hook up with another celebrity. Dick Van Dyke took her in, and they were together for years, since 1976. But she passed away in, I believe it was 2009. And Dick is with his wife, his current wife now, and he's about to turn 100, if he didn't already,
I forget. It's coming in December,
In December, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so what I'm going to say is Marvin was a very, very heavy smoker and drinker. Boy, when you read about the movie, what was the movie in Hawaii with John Wayne? Donovan's Reef, it was called. And Lee Marvin has a great supporting role in that movie. And he's always drunk and they're always fighting. And it's so much fun. Donovan's Reef. It was one of his pre-Oscar performances. Okay, so let's go to our next viewing epic. And this is the GE Theater with Bud Abbott.
And let's do the countdown once again, starting at 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, begin.
Here we go.
And there's Lee Marvin.
Lee Marvin as stand-up comedian. And he's getting big laughs with his snarky material. And he's actually humiliating his agent, his longtime agent, Arnie, who is played by Bud Abbott. I think it's Arnie Kaufman is his name?
I think so.
Yeah. And he's humiliating him. He's looking very uncomfortable, Bud. But look at Bud. He could be a character actor. He could
be
a fine character actor. And he gains a lot of sympathy in this character because he's obviously abused by this comedian. You know, you could just kind of, you know, picture maybe Don Rickles backstage. But although I hear he was a sweetheart. But the plot to this show basically is that you have this harsh comedian who is married to this woman and obviously separated from her, but he keeps giving her checks and he's not happy about it. This is called The Joke's on Me. Again, 1961, Chaplin's birthday, April 16th. And there's co-starring Bud Abbott and Mala Powers, the beautiful Mala Powers playing Lee Marvin's long-suffering wife. So what happens is Lee Marvin sends Bud, his much put upon agent and manager, to bring the check to the wife. And she's ready to get a divorce. She's ready to just end it all. And Bud doesn't want to see that happen. He really is a very sympathetic character here. And he wants to see the kids get together, you know?
Yeah.
So let's talk about Mala Powers. Okay. I did mention that Lee Marvin died in 1986, right?
Yes.
Heavy smoking and drinking and
yep.
respiratory stuff and blah. Anyway, so Mala Powers was born in San Francisco in 1932. Her father was a United Press Associates executive. Her mother was a minister. In 1940, when she was 8 years old, they moved to Los Angeles. That summer, she attended the Max Reinhardt Jr. Workshop. He was a very, very big expat. Acting teacher. She played her first role in a play before a live audience under the guidance of Max Reinhardt. And she continued with her drama lessons. A year later, at age 10, she auditioned and got a part in the 1942 Little Tough Guys film. Now, the Little Tough Guys were at Universal after they left Warner Brothers. And it was Billy Halep, Hunts Hall, Gabe Dell, and who was the other one? Bernard Punsley, all from the old Dead End Kids series. So she got a role in that at 10 years old. It was called Tough as They Come. And those movies are terrible. Tough as They Come means trying to watch them. They tried to turn the Dead End Kids into the Three Stooges. They're always slapping each other and hitting each other in the face with food and stuff like that. It had nothing to do with why we love the Dead End Kids or the Bowery Boys. But anyway, she made that movie. She said she'd been in show business since she was 7 years old. And at the age of 16, she started doing radio. And she became a film actress in 1950. Her first roles were in movies Outrage and Edge of Doom in 1950. Same year, Stanley Kramer signed her to star with Jose Ferrer in Cyrano de Bergerac. In Cyrano, his Oscar-winning performance. And she was nominated for a Golden Globe for that. At 19, she went on a USO tour to Korea to perform for the boys. And apparently, she developed a blood disease, had a severe allergic reaction, and lost most of her bone marrow. She barely survived. When she got back, her recovery took 9 months, almost a year to recover. Wow. She started working again before she was fully recovered. In 1952, she made 3 movies, but she was still heavily on medication. Following her recovery, she appeared in the movie Benghazi with Hillary Clinton. No, I'm kidding. that was in 1956. And then a bunch of B-movies, Rage at Dawn, The Storm Rider, Sierra Baron, and then science fiction films, The Unknown Terror, The Colossus of New York, The Flight of the Lost Balloon, whatever. She made a lot of movies. She did over 100 TV appearances, including Man from U.N.C.L.E., Wagon Train, Bewitched, The Wild Wild West. She was all over the place. Perry Mason, she did a few. By the way, here's Bud doing a scene with Lee Marvin in his dressing room. And you know what? He's not embarrassing himself. Working with this great actor, Lee Marvin, he's holding his own perfectly. Bud, way to go.
Oh, yeah.
So Powers, she eventually started working under Michael Chekhov, the great acting teacher, and became, when he passed away, she was his executrist. For his foundation, his money, and everything else. So she had 3 of his books published posthumously. She took care of his foundation. She went around the country teaching the way he taught. And she was a very important acting teacher after a while. Mala Powers, this B-movie actress. She died from complications of leukemia on June 11, 2007 in Burbank. So yeah, she lived a good long life and she had a good long career. Her last movie was called Hitters in 2002. I think it was the story of Joan Crawford and Bing Crosby. No, I'm kidding. It's a joke. It was a joke. Thanks for getting it, Jerry. Now, the other person I'm going to talk about, well, I think we're going to have to wait because this is going to be ending soon. Yep. Now, I noticed Bud reading from cue cards during this scene. Again, I don't blame him. Marlon Brando did the same thing. John Barrymore did the same thing. He obviously needed a little help. And for all I know, maybe Lou did a few cue cards during his time. Let's face it, they weren't script readers. Yeah. But at this point, they had to be. They had to be.
Yeah.
Look at Mala, how pretty she is. That's a nice close-up of her. And she's just telling him, I want out of this marriage. The beauty of this episode is that what she does with the money that Lee Marvin gives her, she adopts a foreign child who needs help and does it under his name. Mm-hmm. And his reputation is as one of the toughest insult comedians in the business, and he does not want that good guy reputation. That's the contrivance of this plot. So I think that's kind of interesting. That's very good writing, I believe. Mm-hmm. And since we don't have the closing act, let's say, we don't know where it's going. I have a feeling that we're going to see a whole turnaround with Lee Marvin's character. He's eventually going to accept the child, and they're going to get together again. But this is Bud's last scene in the movie, I believe. Look at him. I meant every word of it. He's terrific.
Mm-hmm.
Good work, Bud. Good work. And here we are. We're going. Oh, no, he's got another scene with Lee Marvin in the dressing room. And I think this is the one where Lee Marvin rather callously fires him. And this is really good work by Bud, by the way he reacts to this whole situation. Now, this is where I thought Bud looked older than his years. He put glasses on right now, horn-rimmed glasses. And he's squinting to read what he's reading in his hands, and he looks like he's 70 years old. But that works for him. I really think it works for him because he's not going to play young men. You know, if he continued being cast as a character actor, he would be the older guy in the show.
Yeah.
And Lou could still get away at this point with that baby face, you know, in 1958. So here we go. He's about to fire poor Bud. So that's why you want to postpone. And look at him. Look at Bud. Mm. It's almost stranger to see him working without Lou rather than seeing Lou work without Bud. Do you know what I mean by that?
I do. And I think it might be because in their films, you have made this point a number of times. How many times did Bud turn to Lou and say, "You go do this and I'll be back"? And Lou would do a scene on his own.
You know? Of Lou working solo.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a surprise to see him working solo.
Yeah.
Okay. That's the end of what we have to this episode. And it's directed by Ida Lupino. Folks, if you're a movie buff at all, you know the name Ida Lupino. We're talking A-list movie star who became a feminist's dream by becoming a director. And not just director, but a writer and a composer. I'm going to tell you a little bit about Ida Lupino at this point. She was born in London in 1918 to show business people. She is from a long line of show people. Her mother was Connie O'Shea, an actress, but her father was one of the biggest music hall comedians going at that time, and not just that, movie star as well. So she grew up in privilege. His name was Stanley Lupino, and he was very, very popular. I even have a few of his movies in my collection, and he's very funny. She's also the niece of the more popular Lupino Lane. Now, Lupino Lane was a huge music hall star. Mm-hmm. He was one of the very few to come over to America and have a successful career in silent films and then in early musicals in the late 20s and early 30s. He eventually went back to England and became famous all over again doing the Lambeth Walk. What was the name of the play? Famous British West End play, ran forever, and the Lambeth Walk came out of that, and he became legendary because of it. And he's a very funny man. Not only that, but he was almost as physical as Buster Keaton. He could do the most amazing things with his body. So Ida Lupino came from this lineage. She wanted to be a writer, but her father, and this is very strange, her father insisted she go into show business. So to please her father, she went to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts. How about that? Everyone that saw her work, including her own father, thought she made the perfect bad girl. Prostitutes, you know, duplicitous women, heavily made up, you know, and she was gorgeous. She was a gorgeous female. She made her first movie in England called The Love Race in 1931. That she was 13 years old. At 14, she made a movie with the great director Alan Dwan, who made some great silent films with Douglas Fairbanks and others, a movie called Her First Affair. Her mother tested for the same role, by the way, and they gave it to Ida. Ida done the same thing. So anyway, she's working in England. She worked with John Mills in The Ghost Camera. She made a movie called I Lived With You with Ivor Novello, the biggest competition to Noel Coward at the time. Mm-hmm. She said of her early roles, "My father once said to me, 'You're born to be bad.' And it was true. I made 8 films in England before I came to America and played a tramp or a slut in all of them." So there you go. If you look in the dictionary under the word slut, you'll find the definition. So she was dubbed the English Jean Harlow. And she was discovered by Paramount Studios in 1933. And they actually tested her for Alice in Wonderland. This bad girl.
Wow.
Apparently she didn't get it, of course. She made an impression, again, as mostly a bad girl. But she played a good girl in a movie I love called Anything Goes, based on the Broadway show, the Cole Porter Broadway show. Now, they got rid of most of the score, which was a bad move, but the new songs were great, you know, and they still kept a couple of the Cole Porter songs. And the movie is beautifully filmed and hilariously funny and musically wonderful. So I recommend the movie version from 1936, Anything Goes. Even Margaret Dumont pops up.
Yeah.
So anyway, she made a movie called The Light That Failed with Ronald Colman. And he's an artist that is going blind. She's the Cockney model, and she's horrible. She's the villain of the piece, bad girl. And she made such an impression in this movie that Warner Brothers snapped her up, and she became what she called the B-level Betty Davis. Betty Davis would get all the first choices, and then whatever trickled down, they would give to Ida Lupino. She was always on suspension, always turning down roles, always a thorn in Jack Warner's side, which makes me love her all the more. She made some great movies at Warner's. They Drive by Night with George Raft and Humphrey Bogart. One of my personal favorites, High Sierra with Bogart again. Mm-hmm. That was sort of like Bogart's breakout role before Maltese Falcon. And she made a movie, is one of my all-time favorites. It's called The Hard Way in 1943. And she plays the overbearing sister of Joan Leslie. She's almost like a stage mother, but to the point where she doesn't care who she steps on or who she hurts along the way. And this also has an amazing role, probably the best role ever played by Jack Carson, who happens to be one of my favorite actors. In this movie, he will absolutely break your heart. He's just wonderful. But Ida Lupino is the real star of this movie. And she was nominated for the New York Film Critics Circle Award for this performance. But anyway, she stayed at Warner Brothers. She did a bunch of movies for them. She wasn't crazy about it. Eventually, they offered her another 5-year contract. She said no, and she danced out of the office. Yeah. So what did she do? Her and her husband at the time, Collier Young, who was a producer, they formed an independent company called the Filmmakers Incorporated. And I believe they made like 12 films. And these were low budget, with up-and-coming actors who have not yet made a real reputation, other than people like Edmund O'Brien. He shows up in some. But they were all well-reviewed. Back in 1936, she had polio. She had to fight polio. Mm. And when she finally got her own production company, she made two movies about that plight. I mean, not with her name or anything, but two stories about women who develop polio. And nobody in Hollywood would touch it. None of the major studios would touch it. So she did this. She made this. She also talks about rape in her films, bigamy. Mm-hmm. She wanted to do things that were important, the important issues. But then she'd make like a film noir, like The Hitchhiker with Edmund O'Brien and William Tallman. Wonderful, wonderful stuff. She was a really good director, a good writer, and she made a real name for herself. Once they got rid of the filmmakers, she started doing television like crazy. She got involved with 4-Star Productions, which I mentioned earlier. This was the company owned by Dick Powell and Charles Boyer. And who were the other ones? I can't remember. But anyway, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And she appeared in like 20 of them, for that. She also directed all our favorite television shows, including Twilight Zone. In fact, she was the only person in history to star in a Twilight Zone and to direct. I think she directed two of them. Mm. So she was the only person, and female on top of it. She was an amazing woman. Mm. So she directed that. She directed episodes of Alfred Hitchcock, Boris Karloff's Thriller, Have Gun Will Travel, Honey West, The Donna Reed Show, Gilligan's Island, 77 Sunset Strip, The Rifleman, The Virginian, The Untouchables, The Fugitive, and ding-a-ding-a-ding, Bewitched. But anyway, David Niven was the other guy I was trying to think of from the 4-Star thing. She also had her own sitcom with her then husband, Howard Duff, and that was called Mr. Adams and Eve. They played husband and wife in that. They played film stars, in fact. They had an interesting relationship. They married in the early 50s, but they separated in 1966 and didn't divorce until like 1983. Weird. Anyway, she appeared on television, a lot of television. Her and Howard Duff showed up in one of the Lucy Desi comedy hours, one of the last of those. She appeared on Burke's Law, The Virginian, Nanny and the Professor, Columbo, Streets of San Francisco, Ellery Queen, Policewoman, Charlie's Angels. And she directed a film I saw in the movies, which I absolutely loved, The Trouble with Angels, with Haley Mills and Rosalind Russell. That was her last directing. And I want to mention that when she was recovering from polio and couldn't do anything, basically, she composed a symphony, a suite, a Latin suite, and it was performed by the Los Angeles Philharmonic in 1937. How about that?
Wow.
This was an amazing woman. She died from a stroke while undergoing treatment for colon cancer in 1995 at the age of 77. Her autobiography was published posthumously. Mm-hmm. All right. So that was the Bud Abbott episode of GE Theater. Boy, we are running into time here. Yeah, I'm going to suggest that we just start playing the other stuff. Let's go to the Creature on the Colgate Comedy Hour.
All right, here we go with the countdown. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, begin.
Okay, here we are with the Colgate Comedy Hour. Now, and this is a late in the game Colgate Comedy Hour, because as you know, there were rotating hosts, and Abbott and Costello were one of the more popular rotating hosts of the show. In this one, they're guest stars. And the guy who introduced him is a guy by the name of Gene Wesson, and he was considered one of the a really great comedian. And he was teamed up with a few people. And apparently, Jerry Lewis stole an awful lot from him and their team, by the way. But I'm just throwing that in there. So we're looking at Bud and Lou. Lou has obviously come off an illness. He is thinner than Bud at this point, but he looks great. He's like... Right out of the gate, he's like the horse who wants to get to that track and run, you know. But he's full of ad libs in this, and I'll tell you the truth, the stuff he does later on in the sketch with the creature and Frankenstein monster and all this stuff, it's as good as anything he did in film. He's so good live. I just love him. So here they are. They're in the prop department at Universal, supposedly, and you'll see in the background Mr. Hyde from Abbott and Costello Meet Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Now, the gentleman who is informing them about this place and that it's a haunted place is Norman Abbott. And Norman Abbott was Bud's nephew. And Bud actually helped raise him with his sister when he was born in New York City in 1922. He got into entertainment early. He got into the last days of vaudeville, which means it was presentation houses, movie houses. But he wasn't very successful at that. And if you see him, even in this sketch, he's not very good. And I think Lou knows it as he's working with it. I just get the feeling that he knows they could have done better. but anyway, he also worked in the Borscht Belt circuit some summers up there while he was gaining his skills at the Catskills. So while Abbott and Costello were at MGM filming Rio Rita, Bud arranged for him to have an unbilled bit in the movie. He's the guy who dumps the laundry down the chute, sending Lou down the chute. He got two more small roles in MGM B movies, nothing major, not cast in a name role or anything. And eventually he and Lou's brother, Pat, worked as stand-ins for them, Norman for Bud and Pat for Lou. And that started during Whodunit in 1942. He was also in that. He played the creepy organist during Murder at Midnight. But anyway, here's the most interesting thing, I think. And you know, I'm such a dead-end kids guy. Such a Bowery Boys guy. Bernard Punsley, he was the chubby kid of Dead End Kids. He hated show business. He hated being in those things. He couldn't wait to get out of it. So he joined the Army while they were doing those little tough guy things at Universal. And they needed a replacement for just one movie, for Keep 'Em Sluggin' in 1943. So they hired Norman Abbott to be the fake Bernard Punsley. So Norman was sort of the Curly Joe of Bernard Punsley land. He was Curly Norman. During World War II, he was one of the original Navy SEALs. How about that? Oh. Yeah, He learned how to balance the ball on his nose, and he loved raw fish. After the war, he became a dialogue director on all the Abbott and Costello movies, and he was mentored as a director by our friend Charlie Barton. So while he was, you know, working at a lesser capacity on these films, he was getting a tutorial by Charles Barton, and you can't do better than that.
Yeah.
He later became a director, mostly television. Jack Benny, the Jack Benny program, Leave It to Beaver, Get Smart, The Munsters, Welcome Back, Cutter, Dennis the Menace, and the aforementioned Sanford and Son. He directed mm-hmm. on all of those. This is what interested me because I love the show. The show Sugar Babies, which opened on Broadway in the late 70s, and it was the comeback for Mickey Rooney and Ann Miller, and it was all burlesque routines. And I loved every mm-hmm. second of it. What I didn't know is that the show was the idea, the concept of Norman Abbott. He went to the producers. Yeah. And he was there from the beginning. He helped formulate the show. He had Bud's treasure trove of routines, of the burlesque routines, and they used them. But eventually, they fired him as director. Apparently, he wasn't getting along with the producer, or the concept was not exactly what they wanted eventually. So he was fired after they stole all his ideas and all of Uncle Bud's routines. So there you go. We've got to love show business. Mm. Anyway, he was very, very successful, lived a very long life. I think he was, 93 when he died or something like that. He died recently, July 9th, 2016, in Valencia, California. Mm. And that's where Six Flags Magic Mountain is. Anyway, he was very important to the boys at this point. Okay, and there he is still talking to Bud and Lou, who are now doing the candle bit. They're doing all their horror movie stuff. So this is the candle bit that they did originally in Hold That Ghost, actually originally in Burlesque. And they based the entire movie, Hold That Ghost, on this bit. Lou sold it to the company, actually. So here they are. And look at Lou. His coat is off. He's actually thin. He's thin here. Mm-hmm. And he looks good. He really looks good. It works for him. He doesn't look, you know how some people get really thin and they look older? They look drawn?
Right.
He actually looks good. He looks very good. So anyway, here we go. Lou's like, I tell you, the pen moved. This moved. And doing all that stuff now. He's really good. All right. So we have Norman Abbott there. And soon we're going to be looking at one of my favorite monsters from Universal. In fact, the last great Universal monster was the creature from the Black Lagoon. And Lou is about to meet that monster. They didn't get to do it in the movies. I wish they did.
Yes.
But they didn't. Can you imagine? That might have been the next one after Mummy, you know? I tell you, I jumped in the water and there it was. Are you trying to tell me there's a fish down there that has teeth? It would be interesting. Hillary Brooke in the white bathing suit, you know? oh, gosh. So anyway, let's talk about the creature himself. The creature himself was Ben Chapman. Benjamin F. Chapman Jr. was born in October 29th, 1928. And he played, there were two people who played the creature from the Black Lagoon. There was Riku Browning, who played underwater scenes. He did all the swimming scenes. On land was Ben Chapman. Now, whatchamacallit, he was born in Oakland, California in 1928, spent much of his childhood in Tahiti, which I totally get, because he was a water guy. He was, you know, they practically lived in the water, especially during a tsunami. Yeah. They moved to San Francisco by the time he was 12 or 13 years old. He joined the Marines eventually during the Korean War. He served with the 1st Marine Division. He was believed to have earned a Silver Star, a Bronze Star, and 2 Purple Hearts for battle injuries. However, after his death, the Marine Corps Times began an investigation, and he didn't win any of those. Yeah. So this guy who worked with water had a claim that didn't hold water. So what a weird thing, though. What a weird claim to make. So before he played the creature, before he was hired to do that, he worked as a real estate executive. But anyway, he was selected mostly because he was 6 foot five and he fit the costume. It was made out of foam rubber. It was a full body suit with a big headpiece. And he cited horror film predecessors Lon Chaney Sr., Bela Lugosi, and Boris Karloff and Lon Chaney Jr. As his inspiration for the character, which I find totally bogus. Now I believe the whole thing about the medals. The creature showed none of that. You felt sorry for the creature because he was in love with the girl and, you know, they were shooting him with stuff. We know that he didn't want to harm the girl. It was that whole King Kong thing.
Yeah.
But how he felt he could express emotions like those actors I just mentioned, that's a bit of a stretch. Anyway, so he had to sit down for many breaks because there was no breathing in that outfit. It was very, very difficult. So he passed away shortly after midnight, February 21st, 2008, in Honolulu, Hawaii. His son said that he had heart problems and breathing problems. And he survived by his wife of 25 years. She self-proclaimed herself Mrs. Creature. And his ashes were scattered off the beach at Waikiki. All right, so here we are watching Lou read a script. Now, everybody take a mental picture of this because you'll never see it again. Lou Costello actually reading a script. Now, I'm seeing, is Frankenstein behind him at this point? I had
Not
to
look
down to read my note. Okay. So he's doing this and, it's the lifting the lib squeak thing that he did with Bela in Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. And now he's doing it with the Frankenstein monster. Look at this. I do believe this is Glenn Strange. I really do. I know that Lon Chaney Jr. appeared as the monster in an earlier, one of the first, it may even be the first Colgate Comedy Hour. Oh. But in this one, I believe I read that it was Glenn Strange as the monster. And I know that Lou liked to throw him work every so often. Look, that's pretty good. That's a good mask, actually, when you look at it. He looks like the monster. Lou's having fun. Lou's ad-libbing. He's doing his walk around the monster. Of course, he doesn't see it. He does see the mouse from Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Remember, he becomes the mouse?
Yeah, I was going to say, I never really noticed before. Both that and the Hyde mask seem to be the actual ones from the movie.
Yeah. And look at Lou. And look at Bud. Bud runs through the door. Seeing the monster, he runs right through the door.
Can't blame him.
Yeah, really. And Lou can't figure it out. What's the deal here? Why is Bud acting so strangely? And the monster is right behind him, towering over him, looking very, very scary. Now, Lou's going to do one of the things I love that he does. He just threw the script on the floor so he could bend down to pick it up. And as he bends down to pick it up, he sees between his legs two very large feet behind him. And now he's connecting with us with his face going, huh? Abbott, he's calling for Abbott, but he doesn't have the strength. Abbott, I love this. I just love this. He did this with the mummy in Meet the Mummy.
Mm-hmm.
Same bit. Checking again just to make sure. He takes a step. The monster takes a step. He does it again. He looks like a crab. And the monster is about to strangle him. Now Lou sees the two arms jutting out, and he has to check his own hands to make sure he doesn't have four of them. And now he turns around. Abbott! And I love this. Now the monster gets scared and falls back into the crate. And at that same moment, the creature crashes out of the box. It's a sensational entrance, timed perfectly. And now Lou's going to do his laughter into crying bit. This is just gold. This is gold.
He's and look at them together, seeing Lou with the creature.
Yeah,
incredible.
Yeah,
incredible. That's golden footage. Golden footage. So I'm so glad they guessed it that night, you know, that they actually got to meet the creature. So I hate to say this, Jerry, but I'm going to say let's end this here because we've got a bunch more to look at. And if we continue doing this, it'll go to 2 hours, and we don't want to do that.
This is
so
true.
Let's end it here, and we will next week. We're going to look at some of the Steve Allen guest spots by Lou as a solo. And let's fit in the Wagon Train episode, the Tobias Jones story. We can watch that together.
Yes, okay? Let's do that.
So, but before we commit to that, I'm going to say to our listeners, let us know how this worked for you, if you enjoyed it and you would like us to continue to do this. Now, I know I listen to the Marx Brother Council podcast, mm-hmm. and right now, I don't mean to insult them because it's a great podcast and the guys are fantastic. And Matthew Conium is one of them and he's a friend.
Yeah.
So I just want to say, though, that they went through every movie and now they're going through every movie again. And what they're doing is they're asking people to send in their own thoughts about the movie so they can comment. And I think that's a great idea, something I would like to copy here. But I would like to do it in a way that I will give you my email address and you will send your questions to my email. And we will go over them during the episode. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I would really love to do that. You could talk about anything you want to talk about. And that'll come soon. But if we get a really good response on this show, we will do this again, like I said, with Wagon Train and with the Steve Allen solo spots. And then we'll go on from there. So that's it. That's where we're at. Please take the half a second to subscribe. I'm begging you. I'm on my knees right now. Wait, hold on. I'm on my knees, and I'm pulling over my nephew. Okay, so now I'm on both of them, my niece and my nephew, and I'm begging you. Please, regardless of that joke, and also please hit like. You have to hit like, please. So thank you very much. And Jerry, thank you so much for going through this with me and being such a sport.
Well,
you know, I really appreciate it.
Thank you for wanting to mix it up a little bit because, you know, the question that seems to have been on everybody's lips has been, well, you know, once you've done the movies, where are you going to go from there? So this sounds like a great option.
Absolutely. I thought so too. I almost said absolutely because you said option. A night at the option. So, okay. So that's what we'll do. But I would really love to do the question and answer thing as well.
Sure.
I think I want to do that after the next one. But anyway, guys, thank you for listening in, all of you. Jerry, again, thank you for everything. Enjoy your journey with this Miracle on 34th Street. I'm sure you're kicking it out of the park. and overruled. And you guys, the judge in Miracle on 34th Street. And to our listeners, thank you, thank you, thank you for your support. We really love that you're with us. It's been over a year now. We're friends. We're all family. So keep on listening and we'll keep it coming. Okay? Everybody have a great 2 weeks. And if I don't talk to you, if we don't talk to you before Thanksgiving, have a wonderful Thanksgiving. All right, kids, everybody take care. Lots of love. Mwah! Talk to you soon.